No one wants people to suffer on their way out of life. But how do you plan for a more humane, less prolonged death and still treat disease? I mean, who wants a doctor who's not trying to keep you alive? Dr. Atul Gawande has been talking publicly about that lately. He's a cancer surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston and also a staff writer for The New Yorker. In his newest book, Being Mortal, he writes about feeling frustrated by his own conversations with terminal patients and about trying to find a better approach. Steve Paulson asked him to give us a physician's take on the end of life.
Dr. Gawande, do you think most physicians are good at talking with their patients about matters of death and dying?
No. I think the evidence comes from two directions. My own experience, and I like to think that I'm not completely an outlier in that I was terrible at knowing how to have a successful conversation with people facing terminal illness.
So this was not anything you learned in medical school?
No. I learned virtually nothing about mortality when I was in medical school. I had my cadaver to dissect. But another sign that we don't do very well and that that's had tremendous consequences down the road is that less than a third of cancer patients, for example, in one study, it was looking at patients who on average only had 4 months left to live. And their physicians, only less than a third had a conversation with them about their priorities and goals in their remaining time. The ones who did have that ended up choosing less aggressive therapy for that time. They had less suffering at the end of life. They were more likely to enter hospice. Their families were less likely to have post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms and depression 6 months after. And then in subsequent studies, it was also found that these kinds of conversations not only don't shorten life, in many cases, they lead to longer life by making more toxic therapies less likely to be the things that people take.
Wait, that's fascinating. I mean, that's counterintuitive. You would have think that, you know, if people choose to go ahead with these high-tech end-of-life therapies or procedures or surgeries, that that would extend their lives. You're saying that's not necessarily the case.
And this is what bothers me about the way that the conversation has evolved nationally. It's as if the question is, you know, am I going to get my $80,000 drug that is going to give me 8 more weeks of life? And there's two falsehoods about that. Number one, when it's the fourth round of treatment, you're only getting, in most instances, all the toxicity and none of the benefit. The second part is that we often aren't even honest about the situation you're facing out of anxiety that we might mishandle it. And I have mishandled those conversations.
What are the hardest conversations you have with people?
I found that the hardest conversations were the ones where I didn't know what I was doing. I mean, like even just breaking bad news to people, I felt like sometimes people hated me. and that I wasn't conveying that I was concerned about them. And somehow I was just giving them cold, hard facts. And people described it as when I went back and talked to them, they said, you know, when you told me that, you know, the day I met you that this was not a curable cancer, that we might only have a few years at best, it was like you took a sledgehammer to me. It was as if you didn't really care. And that was the really hard thing because that's not what I wanted to be. It's not who I wanted to be. And I think this is often the experience that patients have.
So we'll take me back to your own, I guess, early career as a doctor. I mean, you're a surgeon. When did you start to learn about how to talk about mortality? I mean, were there particular patients you saw where you realized, oh, you hadn't really done this the right way?
You know, you learn it from the very first time you're just a resident or an intern. I describe one patient who's in his 60s who has a metastatic prostate cancer to his spine. He's becoming paralyzed. Radiation therapy has failed. It's going to be a radical operation through his chest, and he's emaciated and weak, and I have to go in and get his permission. And I didn't even know how to have this conversation to talk about the risks and the benefits and what he could reasonably hope for or not. You learn, you know, by trial and error rather than by saying, you know, this is just like doing a surgical procedure. I was learning step by step what the best way to do a surgical procedure is. The best people I knew in investigating the book, and I watched scores of people have these kinds of conversations, the best ones ended up being ones who treated it like something that you had to be really good at and skilled at. And they broke it down into parts and showed me how you have an effective conversation.
Hmm. There's the art. There's an art to having this conversation, to figure out how to talk about death with someone.
One of the fundamental lessons that came across to me was, number one, people have priorities besides just living longer. And those priorities are really meaningful in their lives. The second thing is that the most reliable way to learn what people's priorities are is to ask about them. And we don't.
Why not? I mean, this seems so obvious, so basic that, first of all, that doctors should be taught how to do this, and second, that it should just be standard procedure in a hospital.
There's so many reasons. One is that our culture in medicine is that the most important values are safety, health, and survival. Those are our priorities. We assume that those are the priorities of anybody coming in to meet us. And what we don't realize is that for most people, a life worth living is bigger than just being safe and alive. The second reason is, look, I'm a surgeon. I get paid so much more to do the procedures than to have a discussion about whether maybe it's not what is most important to you. Every force in the system pushes towards doing more, and you only start to see the inhumanity of it when you see what happens as people's quality of life gets sacrificed along the way.
I want to follow up on that question of trade-offs, because I would think that in many cases that would be extraordinarily difficult. I mean, let's say that someone is old, frail, but, you know, not imminently dying, but has some serious problem, and, you know, you're presented with a choice. You know, you can have this big procedure, and, you know, it could extend your life, or it could set you down an undesirable path. I'm assuming that you face that often.
I tell the story of several patients who came to that path and how it could go wrong and how it could go right. And one of the people with whom I found we were able to make it go right was my father.
He had been a surgeon as well.
He was a surgeon. He was in practice. He was diagnosed with this tumor, and his biggest fear was that his identity was, I'm a surgeon, and that he wasn't going to get to be a surgeon anymore. You know, so he was offered an operation that could try to remove part of the tumor and then also what's called decompress it. So a huge 9-hour operation to fuse his entire spine from the base of his skull to the middle of his back. This was an operation that had a 25% chance of leaving him quadriplegic and being unable to practice. And so he put off undergoing the operation as long as he could while he could still practice. When he started to lose that ability to practice, he retired, he underwent the operation, and he focused on a new goal, which was as long as he could interact with people, be socially engaged, at least a few hours a day, he was a very social creature.
You write about this encounter that you had with a nurse practitioner who worked in hospice. And, you know, this is after your father had, you know, sort of gotten the word that, you know, the prognosis wasn't very good. And so you and your dad and your mom went to see the hospice worker. And it sounds like a very frank conversation.
Yes. So my father, we were going through the options as he became quadriplegic, and it just became more than my mother could handle. In fact, there was this, he had fallen trying to get out of bed in the middle of the night. My mother tried to lift him up, and with her arthritis, ended up on the ground next to him, and then neither could get up off the floor. And they call me, you know, can you come help? And I'm in Boston. They're in rural Ohio. So they get help with a neighbor who gets them up. And by the time I arrive, it's this sort of comic scene. But, you know, I said, well, do we want to have a hospice nurse visit and tell us what the options might be? And my dad said, yeah. And my mom just sort of was silent, like, hospice? What are we talking about?
Yeah, I mean, hospice means you're about to die, right?
If you sign up for hospice, you're certifying that a doctor thinks you have less than 6 months to live. And the hospice nurse came around and said, you know, you understand this is for people with less than 6 months to live. And my mother said, well, we're really thinking about just help for his paralysis. We're not thinking about death right now. And she said, okay, that's fine. What funeral home would you want, Dr. Gawande, when the time comes? And my father immediately said, Jaeger's funeral home, which is down the street from us, and my mother's jaw just dropped. I mean, he'd been thinking about this and been thinking about it for a while.
And they had not talked about it.
They had not talked about it. And that nurse just came in and just said, look, you know, here are the things that we ask about. And at the end of it, my dad said, when can we start?
Wow. What was that like for you being there?
You know, I was sort of the bystander. I mean, two things. Number one, here I am. I've come from Boston. We are like a medical mecca. And I'm coming to rural Ohio. I'm not expecting fabulous here. And this nurse blew me away. She organized treatment that helped him get pain under control in ways that hadn't been under control in months, made it possible for him to get through days on end without multiple falls like he was having. And because he stopped having falls, he got stronger, actually walked again. And it was with their help, 4 more months that we had together.
Yeah. Well, it also sounds like the approach that that nurse took was, it was normal.
Yeah. I mean, the world I trained in and the way I thought of it as a surgeon was that dying is failure. And it is our number one battle. But what I learned from folks like this nurse was that the failure is that we do not make it possible to have as good a life as possible all the way to the very end.
Atul Gawande is a cancer surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, and he's also a staff writer for The New Yorker. Steve talked with him about his most recent book, Being Mortal.